Hello, Anna DeVries here. Since we posted our last episode, we have an update on the disappearance of the first investigator to this case, my missing friend and colleague. Late Friday night, I received a text message from my colleague's cell phone. It read, "Dear Anna, sorry I've been out of touch. I've been swamped with work lately. So much to do and so little time. Feeling fatigued, but I'm doing fine. I'm sorry I made you worry. I'll be in touch soon." Her name was written below that, signing off the message. I was immediately suspicious of this. My colleague has never written to me in that format before. Our texts are usually brief. They lack the formalities of a letter. No capitalizations or punctuation. And she would never, really no friend would ever, sign off with their name. I responded right away. "Call me. I have a new development in our case." As I expected, I received no call. An hour after I sent the message, I received a reply. "Can you text it to me? I'm so busy at the moment." Followed by 3 sad face emojis. I've encountered this strategy in cases before. The killer or kidnapper messages the family or friends of the victim using their phone or email address. They tell them that everything is all right. There's nothing to worry about. I texted again. "I'd really like to hear your voice." Again, no response for quite some time. Then, "I gotta hit the hay. Text me your updates and I'll read through it in the morning and give you a call." I thought they would never call, but then I get this. "Hello, Carla?"
"Hello, Anna? Oh, hey!"
"Carla, are you hurt?"
"No, I'm fine. Right as rain. Anna, I'm so glad you called."
Tell her you have diarrhea."
"I'm sorry, I gotta go. I have diarrhea."
At this point, I am treating my colleague's disappearance as a homicide. To whoever is operating her phone, know this. I am after you. You will not get away. You will not live free for much longer. Be on the lookout.
Welcome back. Connie and Ronnie here, coming to you from the Missouri State Fair.
We're reporting tonight from the corn dog stand as we continue our surveillance of the mangler while he works his day job as a Ferris wheel operator.
Right now, the mangler is just doing his job, running the Ferris wheel, and eating a gyro.
Dog me, Jeffrey.
I'll take a dog as well.
That's the sound of Jeffrey. What's your last name? Whitaker, Jeffrey Whitaker, our resident frightened teen and corn dog
purveyor.
Thank you,
Jeffrey.
We have coerced Jeffrey into letting us use his stand while we continue the surveillance of the mangler.
Although I don't think I can eat very much more watching this lunatic. It's disgusting.
This guy's disgusting. Wait. The only thing more nauseating than his disregard for human life is the way that he refuses to use a napkin while he eats his gyro.
He's just wiping it on his
pants.
He's
covered in sauce, wiping it all over his pants. It's amazing to watch.
Not to mention he's just happily eating his gyro, sitting within the wafting smell of children's vomit.
Yeah, right in the splash zone.
It looks like he's getting off his shift, actually.
Wait, he's coming here. Jeffrey,
take the condiments.
Take the condiments off the table.
Don't give him any more ketchup.
Tell him the ketchup's out.
Enjoy our hygienic tale of horror,
Mr. Clean. The day started like any other. I was called to a crime scene. I pay any coroner or forensic unit that sends a body my way a finder's fee. So I get a lot of calls from the various county units deployed to murders and body discoveries. We have a good thriving business, but it comes with a lot of hazards. We have to protect ourselves against pathogens, mostly. We're exposed to blood matter, brain matter, tissue, excrement, digestive fluids. There are chemical contaminants. Sometimes vermin, fleas, flies. There are a lot of steps before a place goes from being an active crime scene under investigation to a cleanup. The order of work starts after police deem a scene safe to enter. Sometimes animal control needs to be called in to capture or house the victim's dog or cat. Once the aftermath of a crime is documented, the coroner's unit removes the body to the city or county morgue. The evidence department takes stock of any object related to the investigation. And then once the scene is released by detectives, it's our turn. What a lot of people don't know is that it's the responsibility of the loved ones of the deceased to organize the cleanup of a crime scene. These friends and families and roommates are in such a state of shock that they're not going to go looking for a cleaner automatically. Very few have been through the process before, so my business really needs the police to hand over my card. I know a lot of cops, so I've got a ton of business. It was in December, just before Christmas, when I got the call from a woman who said she was referred to me by my friend at the coroner's office. She said that her roommate had been murdered. I listened to the whole story, that she had come home and found her roommate dead from a supposed home invasion. She said that the police were done processing the scene and she wanted it cleaned up immediately since she had nowhere else to go. Apparently, there was a lot of blood, and the prospect of sleeping in the house in such a state was terrifying for this person. Of course, this is understandable, but being a business, we still have to charge the expedited rate for such a quick turnaround. I was already spread pretty thin that day. Usually I work with two colleagues to get a scene in shape as efficiently as possible, but there had been a few bad incidents in the city that day, along with a few residents who had died of natural causes but hadn't been found for some time. I called one of my backup workers, a nurse who moonlights for me, but she was on a shift. So I sent my assistant. He was supposed to arrive by midnight, but by 1 a.m. I get a call from my client that the guy never showed up at the house. I call him and call him. He's not picking up. Honestly, he wouldn't have been the first employee to quit suddenly. Reliable workers are hard to find, especially in positions like this. I was exhausted, but the client was paying our premium rate, so I told her I'd be there shortly. I would have to do this one alone. This is not such a problem, but it takes longer to get the scene in order, and it could be a pain in the ass and the spine if I have to remove something like a mattress or other heavy furniture. I arrived at the house early in the morning, still dark. It was a really nice ranch, two cars in the driveway. I seem to remember one was a Land Rover or some sort of luxury SUV. The lights were on. I knocked, but no one answered, so I rang the doorbell. It was quiet. If no one's present at the residence, typically a key is left with an officer waiting out front in a patrol car, so I can get in. I was ready to leave, thinking nobody was around, but then a man came to the door. I explained who I was and what I was there for. He looked at me like he didn't know what I was talking about. I told him that I was sorry, that maybe I had the wrong address. I turned to go, reasoning that my sleep-deprived or over-caffeinated brain was the cause of the miscommunication. But then the man said, "She's in the kitchen." I wasn't sure if this guy meant the woman who had placed the call and made arrangements for cleanup was in the kitchen, or that the mess was in the kitchen. I've done hundreds of these scenes by now, and it's common for a person close to the deceased person to be sort of out of it when you arrive. In shock, drunk, tranquilized, whatever. I stepped inside past this man and shuffled through the foyer. He told me that he would be in the living room if I needed anything, and then mumbled something about not wanting to be around while I cleaned. I think I said no problem and continued into the kitchen. There was a semi-dried pool of blood in the kitchen. I figured I'd start with that because it would be the easiest to remove and disinfect, especially off linoleum. It's best to tackle the biological material first that can easily be stepped into and spread. Before I got to it, I wanted to assess the whole job. There's no point in cleaning the floor if it's still dripping off the ceiling, you know. I could see that the trail of blood led onto the beige wall-to-wall carpet that stretched down the hallway. From the smears, it seemed that the victim had either crawled down the hall or had been dragged. When rugs are involved, we have to cut out the soiled sections so that we can clean and sanitize the floor underneath. The removed section is thrown out. I don't care if it's an antique rug from Persia, a pint of blood will stain permanently, and it will smell. I went into the living room to inform the man. The living room was dark. I couldn't see anyone in there, and I was hesitant to intrude if the guy was in mourning. So I just stood at the threshold to the living room and said to a dark room, "I'm going to have to cut out the portions of rug where there's blood." I heard a slight ruffle of clothing, and then heard him mutter, "Fine." So I went back to cleaning. First things first, that pool of blood. It's rare that I find blood that hasn't already coagulated and dried, but what I do is pour kitty litter over the blood to absorb it, kind of like what they do to oil spills on the highways. Then I simply scoop it up with a dustpan and dump it into a garbage bag. It's way easier than dealing with mops and buckets. After that, I turn my attention to the rug. I sliced out the section saturated with blood with a box cutter, rolled it up, and placed it in a waterproof construction debris bag. On my knees, I turned and looked down the hallway to the living room. It was still dark, but I could see a faint light on the man's face. I thought that maybe he was on his phone, but as my eyes squinted and adjusted to the lighting of that room, I saw that he had an old camcorder. It was on a tripod and he was staring into its screen. More than that, it was aimed at me. He seemed to shake and I figured he may be watching a home video, remembering this deceased person in his own way. People do strange things when confronted with the death of a loved one. Underneath the carpet was a nice hardwood floor, and I scrubbed that as I went. As I'm working my way down the hallway, slicing and rolling, I noticed that the blood trail turned into one of the bedrooms. I shoved the sections of carpet into bags, lined them up in the hallway, and then went into the bedroom. I turned on the light, and I saw legs. I made a noise and fell backwards against the hallway wall. I immediately started apologizing, thinking I'd walked in on another family member. But when no one responded or made any movement, I peeked in again. The body was wedged partly under the bed. Looked like a man's legs, thick and hairy. He was face down, his legs and back visible, while his head, arms, and upper torso were between the bed and the box spring. He was wearing what looked like a kind of workman's getup, and he had one boot missing from his left foot. I'm thinking, those fucking detectives didn't release the scene yet. The coroner hadn't even been there. I composed myself and went back through the kitchen to the living room to see if I can get any info from the guy before I called the police department. The living room was still dark, but the lights on the Christmas tree near the front window had been lit. I could see now that the living room was pretty large. The open floor plan type you get in some of these rich homes. I said, "Hello?" I heard the man say, "Yes," and looked around, squinting in that dim light to see where he was positioned. I found his outline in a chair in the far corner of the room. He seemed to be shaking, and I assumed he was crying. "Did the police release the scene?" I asked. "I don't know," said the man very quietly. The deceased is still there. The man just said, "Yep." Was the coroner here? I don't know the coroner. You don't need to know the coroner, just, "I don't know," said the man. "Please leave me alone." I had never arrived at the crime scene before the body was picked up. Despite the amount of gore that I had cleaned up over my 4 years on the job, I was creeped out by the presence of the actual body. Seeing blood and the aftermath of the murder is one thing, but being able to concretely see the person it came from is a whole different ballgame. I called the coroner's office. My friend Amy at the front desk picked up, and I gave her the address I was at and asked when their team was coming to retrieve the body from the scene, as I had evidently arrived ahead of them.
"Why are you speaking so softly?" said Amy.
"There's a relative, or friend, I'm not sure which, of the deceased in the next room."
"Oh, okay. Have you started cleaning?"
"Yes, I'm halfway done. I didn't know the body was here, otherwise I wouldn't have started."
"The body's still there?"
"Yeah."
"Those morons."
I could hear her dialing another phone.
"I'm calling the deputy coroner, just a minute."
She kept me on the line as she reached his office and he picked up.
"Hey Al, it's Amy. I've got a cleaner on the line who says he's at a crime scene and the body hasn't been picked up yet."
She gave him the address. I listened as there was confusion.
"Yeah, that's the address the cleaner was given."
Amy gave the deputy coroner the address again to confirm. I could hear his voice increase in volume and speed, but couldn't make out what he was saying. Something seemed wrong. "What's the matter?" I asked Amy. She shushed me while she listened in.
"Are you sure, Al?"
She asked if I was still on the line, and I said yes. Then she told me that she was going to transfer me to the deputy coroner who was currently working on another scene with detectives. They put me on speakerphone.
"Do not ask any questions while we talk."
Trying to make sure that I understood everything he explained. The detective said,
"Okay, first off, we have your address, and officers are on their way to the scene right now."
So the damn scene wasn't even processed?
"I checked with the emergency communication center, and there was no record of an address matching your location. We haven't received any report of a murder or any call from that spot."
"But there's a body here."
"Benny, just listen carefully now. Is there someone at the house with you?"
"Yeah."
"Someone who works with you?"
"No, a relative of the deceased."
"How many?"
"One."
"Do you have them in sight?"
I turned around, surveying the kitchen and the dark shadow of the living room. There was no movement.
"You need to get out of that house at once. Don't let on that we have officers en route. Say this aloud. Repeat after me. I'll have to get my vacuum. It's in my car. Keep us on the line, don't hang up. Benny, say, I'll have to get my vacuum, then calmly walk out of the house and get to your car."
I was too scared to think straight. I said, maybe a bit too loud, I'll be back, I just need to get my vacuum." From there, I couldn't stop myself from nervously narrating. "There's a lot to do, I'll be quick, just need to get a few things. Should be a quick job, not a problem." I stopped hearing the call noise, and when I looked at my phone, the screen was dark. It was dead. "Doesn't matter," I thought. "Get out there as fast as you can." I found the foyer light turned off. It was dark in the hallway and hard to see. I went toward the door, and the shadow passed in front of me. I stopped as the figure stood between me and the front door. He watched me, waiting for me to act. I backed up through the kitchen and, as quickly as I could manage, searched for another way out. I didn't want to take him from my sight, but I had to see where the back door was. With my back turned to the man, the urge to panic welled up. My heartbeat pulsed in my ears. I found the back door and tried to open it, but I needed a key to unlock the deadbolt. When I looked over my shoulder, he was standing in the kitchen, staring at me. "I need your help," he said. "With what?" He slowly approached me and took my hand as if I were a small child, and led me back to the room with the body. I was shaking, I'm sure he could feel it. "It's okay," he said. "We just need to pack things up." He pulled over a huge suitcase that was sitting in the corner of the room and unzipped it. Following his commands, I helped him pull the body by the ankles. The ankle was still warm. He must have died just before I arrived at the house. The body slid out from under the mattress and rolled over. When I saw his face, I dropped his leg to the floor. He told me to help him lift the body, but I couldn't. I knew him. I didn't believe it at first, but I knew him. It was my assistant, Rob. He had slashes on his arms and a few on his face. His hands were covered in stab marks. He must have tried to deflect the blows. Whatever the guy was saying to me, I couldn't really hear him. I was in shock. After a minute, the guy got frustrated and told me to cut out the fabric on the mattress and box spring where there was blood. I took my scissors and I did it as he stuffed Rob into that luggage. It was a pretty big bag, and he didn't have to work too hard. I thought about attacking the guy, but I've never attacked somebody before. The scissors felt slippery in my hands. I didn't think I'd be able to hold onto them tight enough if I went to stab him. He also had this vibe about him, like, if you even try it, I'll be on you fast. The guy was twitchy. I could tell he was quick. He wheeled Rob into the foyer and told me to finish cleaning. He even came back to direct me, pointing out spots I'd missed. My head wasn't screwed on at that point, and I was making mistakes. But I was also, like, taking my time, because I knew the cops were on their way. The whole time I was thinking, fucking get here already. Why are you taking so long? Together, we packed up my van with the garbage bags and loaded up all my cleaning supplies. He rolled Rob to the back door and told me to give him a hand, so I did. What was I supposed to say? No? Give me your keys, he said. I tossed him my key fob. I was praying he'd take my car and leave me, but he told me to get in. I hesitated. I looked around for someone to notice, for what direction to run. He sensed that I was about to take off, and he pulled a small pistol from his pocket and told me to get in the van. We both got in and buckled ourselves, and he drove out of the neighborhood. I could hear the sirens as we pulled onto the county road. We were so close. If they'd only arrived a minute sooner, I wouldn't be where I am at today. He drove us out of town to the edge of a state forest. Off of a fire road, he had a hole already dug. He told me to take Rob out and put him in the hole. Save the luggage, he said. I'll need the suitcase. I thought he was going to do me in too, throw me in the same hole. But the hole was only big enough for Rob. A shovel had been left against a tree. He was in the car watching me. The hole was slightly too small, which made Rob's head hang in a weird angle. The guy leaned out of the van and said, "Just step on the neck, or he won't fit." I tried to pull his body so I could avoid this, but the guy got out of the van and stood over me. "I won't be asking you any more times," he said. I told Rob I was sorry and started pressing on his neck with my foot. But the guy said, "It's gonna take more than that." I pressed harder. The guy snarled at me and said, "Faster." My weight wasn't enough. I had to jump up and down on him, and when that didn't work, I had to stomp. When I heard a snap, I couldn't look. I felt with my foot and felt the sickening roll of the head as it flopped over. I took the shovel and pushed the pile of dirt over his body. When I finished, the guy got out of the van and walked straight into the woods. I couldn't see where he'd gone, but I could hear him stepping on branches, fumbling with something. He emerged from the bushes with a camouflage box in his left hand. He got real close to me, his gun hung at his side, so I said, "Are you gonna kill me?" "Why would I kill you?" He said it like he had no idea what I was talking about. So I said, "Because of Rob, my co-worker." He gave me a curious look, his head tilted slightly. "I don't understand. What do you mean?" "You killed him." "I didn't kill him." At this point, I didn't know what to think. I considered maybe there was another killer that he was working with, so I asked, "Who killed him then?" He cocked his head and squinted at me. Who? You killed him. But he was dead when I found him. Are you sure? Did you check his pulse? He was covered in blood. Those looked like extremity wounds to me, nothing life-threatening. So he wasn't dead? When? At the house? His pulse was strong when I put him in the suitcase. Oh god. We have to get him out of there. I went to grab the shovel. There's no point, his neck's broke. And if the break didn't do it, suffocation only takes about 2 minutes. He's been in there 30. That's when he held up the box in his hands. It was some sort of trail camera. He played back the video of me burying Rob alive. I didn't want to believe it. That was someone else in the video. It wasn't me. It couldn't be. He said, "If you try anything, I'll send this video to the police and show them how your coworker really died. They'll see he was stabbed." But that's not how he died, was it? He put up a fight when I shot him full of Demerol. He was breathing easy when I put him in a suitcase, not a care in the world. Sleepyhead. I killed him? He pushed the camera in my face. Look at the dirty little killer. Look at him. Look at the murderer. He laughed and left with my van, leaving me out there. I couldn't be near Rob's grave any longer. I walked to town. It was morning when I got there. I hitchhiked with the commuter back to my place. After my phone charged enough to turn on, I found dozens of missed calls. The cops were furious. They thought I was playing a prank on them. They didn't find anything at the house. They were even threatening to charge me with making a false report. But they didn't charge me. And I didn't call them back. It wasn't until a week later that they finally reached me. The detective told me that Rob's family had reported him missing. I told him a story, that Rob didn't come in for work one night, and I haven't heard from him since. That wasn't uncommon in my line of work. People flip out. For whatever reason, they left me alone, but they stopped giving out my card. The work stopped coming in. Then, one day, I got a call in the middle of the night. I could tell it was him by his voice. He needed the house cleaned. I hadn't any work for months. Before this job, I worked for 9 years at Home Depot. Do you know what it's like working there? I can't go back to that. It wasn't an easy decision, but I took the job. He calls me regularly now. He's the only one who hires me anymore. What am I supposed to do? I can't say no to work, and besides, he pays. He pays just enough for me to keep going. No more, no less. I'm his faithful servant until the day comes when I either give up or he decides he doesn't need me anymore. That day might come soon.
To welcome a few new sponsors. Phil and Angie's Fingerprint Scalder. Worried that you've been leaving behind identifying evidence of your crime? Use Phil and Angie's Fingerprint Scalder and burn those pesky little swirls right off your fingies. Only $49.99, and if you use the promo code TOUCHY, you can get a 30 set of free hairnets. That's Phil and Angie's Fingerprint Scalder.
Tilly's Bone Wash. The premier dealer in hydrochloric and phosphoric acid in the lower 48. Tilly's Bone Wash provides safe and secure drop-off points for bad boys on the move. No locale is too remote, no terrain is too severe for the delivery drivers at Tilly's Bone Wash. Drop some of Tilly's acid and you won't be taking a trip to prison. Tilly's Bone Wash. Dissolve before you discard.